the ER, he'd lost over 60% of his own. He put down the screwdriver and picked up an equally small wrench. And they gave him another liter in the ambulance before I saw him.
You mean he'd actually lost over 75% of his blood by the time they got him out of that sandwich shop? But can a man lose so much blood and survive?
No,
Sonneford said quietly.
A pleasant shiver passed through Stefan.
And both bullets, lodged in soft tissue but damaged no organs, deflected by ribs? Other bones?
Sonneford was still squinting at the reel but had stopped tinkering with it.
If those 38s had hit bone, the impact would have resulted in chipping, splintering. I found nothing like that.
On the other hand, if they were not deflected by bone, they should have passed through him, leaving massive exit wounds. But I found them lodged in muscle tissue.
Stefan stared at the surgeon's bent head.
Why do I have the feeling there's something more you want to tell me, but that it's something you're afraid to talk about?
At last, Sonneford glanced up.
And why do I get the feeling that you've not told the truth about your reasons for coming here, Father?
Touché, Stefan said.
Sonneford sighed and put the tools away in the kit.
All right.
The entry wounds make it clear that one bullet hit Tulk in the chest, impacted with the lower portion of the sternum, which should have snapped off or fractured. Splinters like shrapnel should have pierced organs, vital blood vessels. Apparently, none of that happened.
Why do you say apparently? Either it happened or it didn't.
From the entry wound in the flesh, I know. That bullet hit the sternum, Father, and I found it lodged harmlessly in tissue on the other side of the sternum. Therefore, somehow, it passed through that bone without damaging it.
Impossible.
Of course.
Yet I found just an entry wound over the sternum, the undamaged bone directly under the wound, and then the bullet lodged inside behind the sternum, with no indication how it had gotten from one place to the other. Furthermore, the entry wound of the second slug was over the base of the fourth rib right side, but that rib was undamaged as well. The bullet should have shattered it.
Maybe you're wrong, Stefan said, playing devil's advocate. Maybe the bullet entered just slightly off the rib between ribs.
No.
Sonneford raised his head but did not look at Stefan. The physician's uneasiness still seemed peculiar and was not explained by what he had said thus far.
I don't make diagnostic errors. Besides, inside the patient, those bullets were lodged where you'd expect them to be if they had hit bone, had punched through, and had had the last of their energy absorbed by the muscle. But there were no damaged tissues between the point of entry and the expended slugs, which is impossible. Bullets can't pass through a man's chest and leave no trail at all.
Almost seems as if we have a minor miracle.
More than minor.
Seems like a pretty damn major miracle to me.
If only one artery and vein were injured, and if both were only nicked, how did Tulk lose so much blood? Were those nicks big enough to account for it?
No. He couldn't have hemorrhaged so massively from those traumas.
The surgeon said nothing more. He seemed gripped in the talons of some dark fear that Stefan could not understand.
What had he to fear?
If he believed that he had witnessed a miracle, should he not be joyous?
Doctor, I know it's difficult for a man of science and medicine to admit he's seen something that his education can't explain. Something that, in fact, is in opposition to everything he had believed to be true. But I beg you to tell me everything you saw. What are you holding back? How did Winton Tulk
lose so much blood if his injuries were so small.
Soniford slumped back in his chair. In surgery, after beginning transfusions, I located the bullets on the X-rays and made the necessary incisions to remove them. In the process, I found a tiny hole in the superior mesenteric artery and another small tear in one of the superior intercostal veins. I was certain there must be other severed vessels, but I couldn't locate them immediately, so I clamped off both the superior mesenteric and the intercostal for repair, figuring to search further when those were attended to. It only took a few minutes, an easy task. I sewed the artery first, of course, because the bleeding was in spurts and was more serious. Then, Father Vikazik urged gently. Then, when I had quickly finished stitching the artery, I turned to the torn intercostal vein, and the tear was gone.
Gone, Stefan said. A quiver of awe passed through him, for this was the thing he had expected. Yet it was also a revelation of such astounding importance that it seemed too much to have hoped for.
Gone, Soniford repeated, and at last he met Stefan's gaze. In the surgeon's watery gray eyes, a shadow moved like the half-perceived passage of a leviathan through the depths of a murky sea. The shadow of fear. And Stefan confirmed that for some inexplicable reason the miracle occasioned dread in the doctor.
The torn vein healed itself, Father.
I know the tear had been there. Clamped it off myself. My technician saw it. My nurse saw it, but when I was ready to sew it up, the rent was gone.
Healed.
I removed the clamps and the blood flowed again through the vein and there was no leakage. And later, when I excised the bullets, the muscle tissue appeared to knit up before my eyes.
Appeared to?
No. That's an evasion,
Soniford admitted. It did knit before my eyes.
Incredible. But I saw it.
Can't prove it, Father.
But I know those two slugs did smash Toke's sternum and shatter his rib. They did send bone fragments through him like shrapnel. Major, mortal damage was done. Had to have been. But by the time he was on the table in surgery, his body had almost entirely healed itself. The shattered bones had reformed. The superior mesenteric artery and the intercostal vein were severed to begin with, which is why he lost blood so fast. But by the time I opened him, both vessels had knitted up except for a small tear in each.
Sounds crazy.
But if I hadn't moved to repair the artery, I'm sure it would have finished closing on its own, just as the vein did.
What did your nurse and other assistants think of this?
Funny thing is, we didn't talk much about it. I can't account for how little we discussed it. Maybe we didn't talk about it because we're living in a rational age when the miraculous is unacceptable.
How sad, if true, Stefan said.
With the shadow of dread still shimmering anemone-like in the depths of his eyes, Soniford said,
Father, if there is a God, and I'm not admitting there is, why would he save this particular cop?
He's a good man, Father Vikazik said.
So? I've seen hundreds of good men die. Why should this one be saved and none of the others?
Father Vikazik pulled a chair around from the side of the desk in order to be able to sit near the surgeon.
You've been frank with me, Doctor. So I'll be up front with you. I sense a force behind these events that's more than human. A presence. And that presence isn't primarily concerned with Winton Toke,
But with Brendan, the man, the priest who first reached Officer Tok in that sandwich shop.
Bennett Sonneford blinked in response.
Ah.
But you wouldn't have gotten such a notion unless...
Unless Brendan was linked to at least one other miraculous event, Stefan said. Without using Emmy Hallberg's name, he told Sonneford about the girl's mending limbs that had once been crippled by disease. Instead of taking hope from what Stefan told him, Bennett Sonneford shriveled farther in the heat of his strange despair. Frustrated by the physician's relentless gloominess, Father Vikazic said, "Doctor, maybe I'm missing something, but it seems to me you've got every reason to be joyous. You were privileged to witness what I personally believe was the hand of God at work."
He held one hand out to Sonneford and was not surprised when the doctor gripped it tightly.
"Bennett, why are you so despondent?"
Sonneford cleared his throat and said,
"I was born and raised a Lutheran, but for 25 years I've been an atheist. And now..."
"Ah, I see."
Happily, Stefan began angling for Bennett Sonneford's soul in the fish-lined den. He had no suspicion that, before the day was done, his current euphoria would be dispelled, and that he would experience a bitter disappointment.
Reno, Nevada. Zeb Lomax had never imagined that his life would end in bloody suicide on Christmas, but by that night he had sunk so low that he longed to end his existence. He loaded his shotgun, put it on the filthy kitchen table, and promised himself that he would use it if he was unable to get rid of all the goddamned moon stuff before midnight. His bizarre fascination with the moon had begun the summer before last, though at first it had seemed innocent enough. Toward the end of August that year, he had taken to going out on the back porch of his cozy little house and watching the moon and stars while sipping Coors. In mid-September, he purchased the Tasco 10VR refracting telescope and bought a couple of books on amateur astronomy. Zebediah was surprised by his own sudden interest in stargazing. For most of his 50 years, Zeb Lomax, a professional gambler, had shown little interest in anything but cards. He worked Reno, Lake Tahoe, Vegas, occasionally one of the smaller gambling towns like Elko or Bullhead City, playing poker with the tourists and local would-be poker champs. He was not only good at card games, he loved cards, more than he loved women, booze, food. Even the money was not important to Zeb, it was just a handy byproduct of playing cards. The important thing was staying in the game. Until he got the telescope and went crazy. For a couple of months he used the scope on a casual basis, and he bought a few more books on astronomy, and it was just a hobby. But by last Christmas he began to focus his attention less on the stars than on the moon. And thereafter, something strange happened to him. The new hobby soon became as interesting as card games, and he found himself canceling planned excursions to the casinos in order to study the lunar surface. By February, he was glued to the eyepiece of the Tasco every night that the moon was visible. By April, he built a collection of books about the moon that numbered more than 100, and he went out to play cards only 2 or 3 nights a week. By the end of June, his book collection had grown to 500 titles, and he had begun to paper the bedroom walls and ceiling with pictures of the moon, clipped from old magazines and newspapers. He no longer played cards, but began living off his savings, and thereafter his interest in things lunar ceased to bear any resemblance to a hobby, and became a mad obsession. By September, his book collection had grown to more than 1,500 volumes, stacked throughout his small house. During the day, he read about the moon, or, more often, sat for hours staring intently at photographs of it, unable either to understand or to resist its allure, until its craters and ridges and plains became as familiar to him as the five rooms of his own house. On those nights when the moon was visible, he studied it through the telescope until he could no longer stay awake, until his eyes were bloodshot and sore. Before this obsession took control of him, Zeb Lomax had been a ruggedly hewn and relatively fit man. But as his preoccupation with things lunar tightened its grip, he stopped exercising and began eating junk food. Cake, ice cream, TV dinners, bologna sandwiches, because he no longer had time to prepare good meals. Furthermore, the moon not only fascinated him, but also made him uneasy. Filled him not only with wonder, but with dread. So he was always nervous, and he tranquilized himself with food. He became softer, flabbier, though he was only minimally aware of the physical changes he was undergoing. By early October, he thought about the moon every hour of every day, dreamed of it, and could go nowhere in his house without seeing hundreds of images of the lunar face. He had not stopped repapering the walls when he had finished his bedroom in June, but had carried that project throughout. The full-color and black-and-white moon pictures came from astronomy journals, magazines, books, and newspapers. On one of his infrequent ventures out of the house, he had seen a 3x5-foot poster of the moon, a color photograph taken by astronauts, and he had bought 50 copies, enough to paper the ceiling and every wall in the living room. He had even taped the poster over the window so every square inch of the room was decorated with that repeating image, except for doorways. He moved the furniture out, transforming the empty chamber into a planetarium where the show never changed. Sometimes he'd lie on his back on the floor and stare up and around at those 50 moons, transported by an exhilarating sense of wonder and an inexplicable terror, neither of which he could understand. Christmas night, as Zeb was sprawled on the floor with 50 bloated moons hanging over him, bearing down on him, he suddenly noticed writing on one of them, a single word scrawled across the lunar image with a felt-tipped pen, where there had never been a word before. The picture had been defaced with a name, Dominic. He recognized his own handwriting, but he could not remember having scrawled that name across the moon. Then his eye was caught by another name written on another poster, Ginger, and then a third name on a third poster, Faye, and a fourth, Ernie. Suddenly anxious, Zeb stumbled around the room checking the other posters, but he found no more names. In addition to being unable to recall writing those words, he could not think of anyone he knew named Dominic, Ginger, or Faye. He knew a couple of Ernie's, though neither was a close friend, and the appearance of that name on one of the moons was no less mysterious than the three others. Staring at the names, he grew increasingly uneasy, for he had the odd feeling that he did know them, that they had played a terribly important role in his life, and that his very sanity and survival depended on remembering who they were. Some long-forgotten memory swelled in him like a steadily inflating balloon, and intuitively he knew that when the balloon popped, he would recollect everything, not only the identities of these four people, but also the origins of his fevered fascination with and underlying fear of the moon. But as the memory balloon swelled within him, his fear grew as well, and he began to sweat and then to shake uncontrollably. He turned from the posters, suddenly terrified of remembering, and lurched out to the kitchen, driven by that gnawing hunger that was always occasioned by thoughts that made him nervous. He wrenched open the refrigerator door and was startled to discover that the shelves were bare. They held dirty bowls and empty plastic containers in which food had been kept, two empty milk cartons, an egg carton with one broken and dried egg. He looked in the freezer, found only frost. Zeb tried to remember when he had last been to the supermarket. It might have been days or weeks since his most recent shopping expedition. He could not remember because in his moon-filled world, time no longer had any meaning. And how much time had passed since his last meal? He vaguely remembered having some canned pudding, but he was not clear whether that had been earlier today or yesterday, or even 2 days ago. Zebediah Lomax was so shocked by this development that his mind cleared for the first time in weeks, and when he looked around the kitchen, he made a strangled sound of disgust and fear. For the first time he saw, really saw, the mess in which he'd been living, a situation previously masked by his all-encompassing fascination with the moon. Garbage covered the floor. Discarded cans, sticky with fruit juice, slimy with traces of rancid gravy, empty cereal boxes and a score of drained milk cartons, dozens of wadded-up and discarded potato chip bags and candy wrappers, and roaches. They squirmed, scuttled, and jigged through the garbage, raced across the floor, climbed walls, crouched on counters, and lurked in the sink. "My God," Zeb said, in a voice that was hardly more than a croak. "What's happened to me? What have I been doing? What's wrong with me?" He put one hand to his face and twitched with surprise when he felt a beard. He had always been clean-shaven, and he had thought he shaved just this morning. The wiry hair on his face sent him in a panic to the bathroom where he could look in the mirror. He saw a stranger, filthy, matted hair, hanging in tangled clumps, pale, soft, sickly-looking skin, a 2-week beard crusted with food and dirt, wild eyes. He became aware of his body odor. His stink was so rank that he gagged on his own aroma. Apparently he had not bathed in days, weeks. He needed help. He was sick, confused and sick. He could not understand what had happened to him, but he knew that he must go to the telephone and call for help. But he did not go immediately to the phone, because he was afraid they'd say he was hopelessly insane and would lock him away forever, like they had locked away his father. When Zebediah was 8, his father pitched a terrible fit, ranting and raving about lizard things that were crawling out of the walls, and the doctors took him to the hospital to dry him out. But that time, unlike before, the DTs had not gone away, and Zeb's dad had been institutionalized for the rest of his life. Ever after, Zeb had been afraid his own mind might be flawed, too. Staring at his pale face in the mirror, he knew he could not call for help until he made himself presentable and straightened up the house. Otherwise, they would lock him up and throw away the key. He could not bear to look at his reflection long enough to shave, so he decided to deal with the house first. Keeping his head down to avoid seeing the moons, which exerted a tidal force on him as real as the true moon's effect on the seas, he scurried into the bedroom, opened the closet, shoved the clothes aside, located his Remington 12-gauge and a box of shells. Head bowed, fighting the urge to look up, he made his way to the kitchen, where he loaded the shotgun and put it on the garbage-strewn table. Speaking aloud, he made a bargain with himself.
"You get rid of the moon books. Tear down the pictures so this place don't look so crazy. Clean the kitchen. Shave. Bathe. Then maybe you'll get your head clear enough to figure what the hell's wrong with you. Then you can get help. Just not while things are like this."
The shotgun was the unspoken part of the bargain. He had been fortunate to to rise briefly out of the moon dream in which he had been living, shocked to his senses by the lack of food in the refrigerator. But if he drifted back into that nightmare, he could not count on being jolted awake again. Therefore, if he could not resist the siren song of the moons on the walls, he would quickly return to the kitchen, pick up the shotgun, put it in his mouth, and pull the trigger. Death was better than this. And death was better than being locked up forever like his father. Now, in the living room once more, keeping his eyes on the floor, he began to gather up the books. Some had once boasted jackets with photos of the moon, but he had clipped those pictures. He hefted an armload of them and went outside to the snow-covered backyard, where there was a barbecue pit lined with concrete blocks. Shivering in the crisp winter air, he dumped the books into the pit and headed back to the house for more, not daring to look at the night sky for fear of the great luminous body suspended in it. As he worked, the urge to return to the study of the moon was as intense and demanding as the hideous need that forced a heroin addict to return again and again to the needle. But Zeb fought it. Likewise, as he made trip after trip to the barbecue pit, he felt that memory of some long-forgotten event continuing to swell within him. Dominic, Ginger, Fay, Ernie. Instinctively, he knew that he would understand the cause of his fascination with the moon if only he could recall who those four people were. He concentrated on the names, trying to use them to block out the alluring summons of the moon. And it seemed to work because soon he had disposed of 200 or 300 volumes in the barbecue pit and was ready to set them ablaze. But when he struck a match and leaned down to light the pages of a book, he discovered the pit was empty. He stared in shock and horror. Dropping the matches, he raced back to the house, threw open the kitchen door, stumbled inside, and saw what he had been most afraid of seeing. The books were piled there, damp with snow, smeared with wet ashes from the pit. He had indeed disposed of them. But then the lunacy had taken him again. Under its spell, and without knowing what he was doing, he had carried every volume back into the house. He began to cry, but he was still determined he would not wind up in a padded room. He picked up a score of books and headed back toward the barbecue pit, feeling as if he were in hell and condemned for eternity to the performance of this frantic ritual. When he figured he had filled the pit again, he suddenly realized he was not carrying books to the place of burning, but away from it. Again he had drifted off into his moon dream, and instead of destroying the objects of his obsession, he was recollecting them. As he headed back toward the house, he noticed how the crust of snow glimmered with a scintillant, reflected light. Against his will, his head came up. He looked into the deep and nearly cloudless sky. He said, "The moon." He knew then that he was a dead man. Laguna Beach, California. For Dominic Corvaces, Christmas was usually not much different from other days. He had no wife or children to make it special. Raised in foster homes, he had no relatives with whom he could share a turkey and mincemeat pie. A couple of friends, including Parker Fain, always invited him to join in their festivities, but he declined, for he knew he would feel like the proverbial fifth wheel. However, Christmas was not sad or lonely. He was never bored by his own company, and his home overflowed with good books that could fill the day with delight. But this Christmas, Dom could not concentrate to read, for he was preoccupied by the mysterious mail he had received the previous day, and by the need to resist the urge to pop a Valium.
Though he had been afraid that he would dream and walk in his sleep, he had taken no Valium yesterday and no Dalmane last night. He was determined to avoid any further reliance on chemicals, though he continued to crave them. In fact, the craving became so bad that he emptied the pills into the toilet and flushed them away, because he did not trust himself. As the day wore on, his anxiety rose to the level he had experienced before he had begun drug therapy. At 7 o'clock Christmas night, Dom arrived at Parker's rambling hillside contemporary and accepted a glass of homemade eggnog with a cinnamon stick in it. The burly painter's beard, usually bushy and untamed, was neatly trimmed, and his mane of hair was newly cut and combed in honor of the holiday. Though he was more conservatively groomed and more subdued in dress than was his habit, he was every bit as ebullient as one expected him to be.
"What a Christmas! Peace and love reigned in this house today, I tell you. My cherished brother made only 40 or 50 nasty and envious remarks about my success, which is not half as many as he lets loose with on a less blessed occasion. My sainted half-sister Carla only once called her sister-in-law Doreen a bitch, and even that might be considered justified in light of the fact that Doreen started it by calling Carla a brainless new-age crackpot full of psychobabble. Ah, truly, a day of fellowship and caring. Not one punch thrown this year, if you can believe it. And Carla's husband, though he got plastered as usual, did not throw up or fall down a flight of stairs as in the past years, though he did insist on doing his Bette Midler imitation at least a dozen times.
As they moved toward a grouping of chairs by the window wall overlooking the sea, Dom said,
"I'm going on a trip. A long drive. I'll fly to Portland and rent a car up there. Then I'll retrace the journey I took the summer before last, from Portland down to Reno, across Nevada and half of Utah on Interstate 80, then to Mountain View."
Dom sat down as he spoke, but Parker remained on his feet, very still. The announcement pleasantly electrified him.
"What's happened? That's no vacation. That's not a route you'd take for pleasure. Are you sleepwalking again?"
"Must be."
"And something's happened to convince you this is related to the changes you underwent that summer."
"I haven't begun sleepwalking again, but I'm sure I will. Probably tonight, because I've thrown the damn drugs away. They weren't curing me. I lied. I was getting hooked, Parker. I didn't care because it seemed that being hooked was better than enduring the things I did while sleepwalking. But now, all that's changed because of these."
He held up the two notes from his unknown correspondent.
"The problem's not just within me, not just psychological. There's something stranger at work here."
He gave the first note to Parker. His fearful state of mind was betrayed by the sheet of paper which shook in his hand. When the painter read it, he looked baffled. Dom said,
"It came in the mail yesterday at the post office. No return address. There was another note delivered to the house."
He explained about having typed the words "the moon" on his word processor hundreds of times in his sleep, and about waking from a dream with those same words on his lips, then passed the second note to Parker.
"But if I'm the first one you've told about this moon thing, how could anyone have known enough to send such a note?" "Whoever he is," Dom said, "he knows about my sleepwalking. Maybe because I've gone to a doctor about it."
"You're saying you're being watched?"
"Apparently, to a degree. Periodically monitored, if not constantly watched. But while the monitor knows about my sleepwalking, he probably doesn't know about my typing those words on the display writer, or that I woke up repeating them in the night, not unless he was standing beside my bed, which he wasn't. However, he indisputably does know that I'll react to the moon, that those words will frighten me. So he must know what lies behind this whole crazy mess."
At last Parker sat down on the edge of a chair.
Find him, and you'll know what's going on.
New York is a big place,
Dom said. I have no starting point there. But when I got this first, you know, this business about the answer to my sleepwalking, lying in the past, I realized you must be right about this personality crisis being tied to the previous one. The dramatic change I went through on the trip from Portland to Mountain View is somehow connected. If I make that trip again, stop at the same motels, eat in the same roadside restaurants, try to recreate it as exactly as I can, something might turn up. My memory might be jogged. But how could you have forgotten something so major? Maybe I didn't forget it. Maybe the memory was taken from me.
Leaving that possibility for later exploration, Parker said,
Whoever the hell this guy is, what reasons would he have for sending these notes? I mean, you've imagined a situation where it's you against them, some unknown them, and so this guy is on their side, not yours.
Maybe he doesn't agree with everything that's been done to me. Whatever it is that I've forgotten was done to me.
Done to you? What are we talking about here?
Dom nervously turned his glass of eggnog around and around in his hands.
I don't know.
But this correspondent, he obviously wants me to know my problem's not psychological, that there's something more behind it. I think maybe he wants to help me find the truth.
So why doesn't he just call you up and tell you the truth?
The only thing I can figure is that he doesn't dare risk telling me. He must be part of some conspiracy.
God knows what.
But part of some group that doesn't want the truth to come out. If he approaches me directly, the others will know and he'll be in deep shit. As if it helped him think, Parker ran one hand through his hair several times, mussing it badly.
You make this sound like some all-knowing secret society is on your ass, like the Illuminati Society. Rosicrucians, CIA, and the Fraternal Order of Masons all rolled into one. You actually think you've been brainwashed?
If you want to call it that. Whatever traumatic episode I've forgotten, I didn't forget it without assistance. Whatever I saw or experienced was apparently so shocking, so traumatic, that it's still festering in my subconscious, trying to reach me through sleepwalking and through the messages I leave on the display writer. It was so damn big that even brainwashing hasn't been able to wipe it out. So big that one of the conspirators is risking his own neck to send me hints.
After reading them one more time, Parker returned the two notes to Dom, chugged down his own eggnog.
Shit. I think you've got to be right, which upsets me. I don't want to believe it. It sounds too much as if you've let your novelistic imagination run wild, as if you're trying out the plot of a new book on me, something a bit more colorful than you should write. But crazy as the whole thing sounds, I can't think of any other answer.
Dom realized he was squeezing the eggnog glass so tightly that he was in danger of shattering it. He put it on a small table and blotted his hands on his slacks.
Me neither.
There's nothing else that explains both the crazy damn sleepwalking and my personality change between Portland and Mountain View and those two notes.
His face lined with worry, Parker said,
What could it have been, Dom? What did you stumble into when you were out there on the road?
I don't have the foggiest.
Have you considered that it might be something so bad, so damn dangerous, that you'd be better off not knowing?
Dom nodded.
But if I don't learn the truth, I won't be able to stop the sleepwalking for good. In my sleep, I'm running from the memory of whatever happened to me out there on the road the summer before last. And to stop running, I've got to find out what it was, face up to it. Because if I don't stop the sleepwalking, it'll eventually drive me mad.
That might sound a bit melodramatic, too, but it's true. If I don't learn the truth, then the thing I fear in my dreams is going to start haunting the waking hours as well, and I'm not going to have a moment's peace, waking or sleeping. And eventually the only solution will be to put a gun in my mouth and pull the trigger.
Jesus.
I mean it.
I know you do.
God help you, my friend. I know you do.
Reno, Nevada. A cloud saved Zeb Lomac. It drifted across the moon before the grip of the lunar obsession had completely reclaimed him. With the empyreal lantern briefly dimmed, Zebediah abruptly became aware that he was standing coatless in the freezing December night, gaping up at the sky, mesmerized by moonbeams. If the cloud had not broken the trance, he might have stood there until the object of his grim fascination had descended past the horizon. Then, having sunk back into his lunacy, he might have returned to one of the rooms papered with the ancient god-face that the Greeks called Cynthia, that the Romans called Diana, there to lie in a stupor until days hence he had starved to death. Reprieved, he let out a wretched cry and ran to the house. He slipped and fell in the snow, fell again on the porch steps, but immediately scrambled up, desperately seeking the safety of the indoors where the face of the moon could not work its charms on him. But of course there was no safety inside either. Though he closed his eyes and began at once to tear blindly at the moon pictures, ripping them from the kitchen walls and casting them on the garbage-covered floor, he began to succumb to his obsession yet again. Eyes tightly shut, he could not see the cratered images, but he could feel them. He could feel the pale light of 100 moons upon his face, and he could feel the roundness of the moons in his hands as he tore them off the wall, which was crazy, because they were only pictures that could not produce light or warmth and could not convey by touch the roundness of the lunar globe, yet he nevertheless felt those things strongly. He opened his eyes and was instantly captured by the familiar celestial body.
Just like my dad. Asylum bound.
Like a distant crackle of lightning, that thought flickered through Zeb Lomax's rapidly dimming mind. It jolted him and allowed him to recover just long enough to turn away from the living room door and fling himself toward the kitchen table where the loaded shotgun waited. Chicago, Illinois. Father Stefan Vikazik, descendant of strong-willed Poles, rescuer of troubled priests, was not accustomed to failure, and he did not handle it well.
But after everything I've told you, how can you still not believe? He demanded.
Brendan Cronin said,
Father Stefan, I'm sorry, but I simply don't feel any stronger about the existence of God than I did yesterday.
They were in a bedroom on the second floor of Brendan's parents' ginger-snap brick house in the Irish neighborhood called Bridgeport, where the young priest was spending the holiday according to Father Vikazik's orders, issued yesterday after the uptown shootout. Brendan, dressed in gray slacks and a white shirt, was sitting on the edge of a double bed that was covered by a worn yellow chenille spread. Stefan, choosing to feel needled by his curate's stubbornness, moved constantly around the room from dresser to highboy to window to bed to dresser again, as if trying to avoid the prickling pain of his failure.
Tonight, Father Vikazik said, I met an atheist who was half converted by Tok's incredible recovery, but you're unimpressed.
I'm happy for Dr. Sonneford, Brendan said mildly. But his renewed belief doesn't rekindle my own.
The curate's refusal to be properly impressed by recent miraculous events was not the only thing that irritated Father Vikazik.
The young priest's pacific demeanor was also bothersome. If he could not find the will to believe in God again, then it seemed he should at least be disheartened and downcast by his continued lack of faith. Instead, Brendan appeared untroubled by his miserable spiritual condition, which was quite different from his attitude when Father Vikazic had seen him last. He had changed dramatically. For reasons that were not at all clear, a great peace seemed to have settled over Brendan. Still determinedly pressing his argument, Stefan said, "It was you, Brendan, who cured Emmy Hallberg and healed Winton Toke. It was you, through the power of those stigmata on your hands, stigmata that God visited upon you as a sign." Brendan looked at his palms, now unmarked.
"I believe. Somehow I did heal Emmy and Winton. But it wasn't God acting through me."
"Who else but God could have granted you such curing power?"
"I don't know," Brendan said. "Wish I did. But it wasn't God. I felt no divine presence, Father."
"Good grief! How much more strongly do you expect him to make his presence felt? Do you expect him to thump you on the head with his great staff of justice? Tip his diadem to you and introduce himself? You got to meet him halfway, Brendan!"
The curate smiled and shrugged.
"Father, I know these amazing events seem to have no explanation other than a religious one, but I feel very strongly that something other than God lies behind it."
"Like what?"
Stefan challenged.
"I don't know. Something tremendously important. Something really wonderful and magnificent. But not God. Look, you've said that the rings were stigmata. But if that's what they were, why wouldn't they have been in a form that had some Christian significance? Why rings, which seem to have no relation to the message of Christ?"
When Brendan began Stefan's unconventional course of psychological therapy at St. Joseph's Hospital for Children 3 weeks ago, the young priest had been so troubled by his loss of faith that he'd been growing rapidly thinner. Now, he had stopped losing weight. He was still 30 pounds lighter than usual, but he was no longer as wan and haggard as he had been following his shocking outburst during Mass on the 1st of December. In spite of his spiritual fall, there was a glow to his skin and a light in his eyes that was almost beatific.
"You feel splendid, don't you?" Stefan asked.
"Yes, though I'm not sure why."
"Your soul's no longer troubled?"
"No."
"Even though you've still not found your way back to God?"
"Even though," Brendan agreed. "Maybe it has something to do with the dream I had last night."
"The black gloves again?"
"No, haven't had that one in a while," Brendan said. "Last night, I dreamed that I was walking in a place of pure golden light. Beautiful light. So bright, I could see nothing around me, and yet it didn't hurt my eyes." A peculiar note, perhaps of reverence, entered the curate's voice. "In the dream, I keep walking and walking, not knowing where I am or where I'm going, but with a sense that I'm approaching a thing or a place of monumental importance and unbearable beauty. Not just approaching, but being called to it. Not an audible call, but a summons that just reverberates in me. My heart is pounding, and I'm a little afraid, but it isn't a bad fear, Father. What I feel in that bright place, not bad at all. So I just keep walking through the light, towards something magnificent that I can't see, but that I know is there."
Drawn by Brendan's hushed voice, as if by a magnet, Father Vikazic moved to the bed and sat upon the corner of it.
"But surely,"
This is a spiritual dream. The call of God coming to you in sleep. He's calling you back to your faith, back to the duties of your office.
Brendan shook his head. No. There was no religious quality to the dream, no sense of a divine presence. It was a different kind of awe that filled me, a joy unlike the joy I knew in Christ. I woke up 4 times during the night, and each time I woke, the rings were on my hands, and each time that I fell back to sleep, I dropped into the same dream again. Something very strange and important is happening, Father, and I'm a part of it. But whatever it is, it's not anything that my education, experiences, or previous beliefs have prepared me for.
Father Vikazic wondered if the call that had come to Brendan in the dream had been from Satan instead of God. Perhaps the devil, aware that a priest's soul was in jeopardy, had dressed his hateful form in this deceptively attractive golden light, the better to lead the curate from the righteous path. Still firmly determined to bring his curate back into the fold, but temporarily out of winning strategies, Stefan Vikazic decided to call a truce. He said,
"So, what now? You aren't ready to put on your Roman collar and resume your duties, as I thought you'd be by now. Do you want me to contact Lee Kellogg, the Illinois provincial, and ask him to authorize psychiatric counseling?"
Brendan smiled. "No, that doesn't appeal to me anymore. I don't believe it'd do any good. What I'd like to do, if it's all right with you, Father, is move back into my room in the rectory and wait this out. See what happens. Of course, as I remain a fallen-away priest, I can't hear confessions or say Mass. But while I'm waiting to see what happens, I could do some cooking, help you catch up on the filing."
Father Vikazic was relieved. He had expected Brendan to express the intention of returning to a secular life.
"You're welcome, of course. There's much you can do. I'll keep you busy, no need to worry about that. But tell me, Brendan, you do think there's a possibility that you'll find your way back?"
The curate nodded. "I don't feel alienated from God anymore. Just empty of him. As this situation develops, perhaps it'll lead me back to the church, as you're convinced it will. I just don't know."
Still frustrated and disappointed by Brendan's refusal to see the miraculous presence of God in the healing of Emmy and Winton, Father Vikazic was nonetheless glad that he would have the curate close and be provided the opportunity to continue guiding him back to salvation. Brendan went downstairs with Father Vikazic, and at the front door the two men embraced in such a way that a stranger, without any knowledge of their occupation, would have thought them father and son. Accompanying Father Vikazic as far as the front stoop, where a blustery wind gave a howl more suited to Halloween than to Christmas, Brendan said,
"I don't know why or how, Father Stefan, but I feel we're about to embark upon an amazing adventure."
"The discovery or rediscovery of faith is always an amazing adventure, Brendan," Father Vikazic said. Then, having gotten in the last clean jab as a good fighter for souls should always do, he left.
Reno, Nevada. Whimpering, gasping for breath, struggling valiantly against the narcotizing effect of his lunar obsession, Zeb Lomak clambered through the garbage and squirming roaches that carpeted the kitchen, grabbed the shotgun that lay upon the table, jammed the barrel between his teeth, and suddenly realized that his arms were not long enough to reach the trigger. The urge to look up at the bewitching moons on the walls was so overpowering that he felt as if someone had hold of him by the hair and was pulling his head back to force his gaze up from the floor. And when he closed his eyes defensively, it seemed as if some invisible adversary began to pry insistently at his eyelids. In his horror of being committed to a madhouse like his father,
he found the strength to resist the mesmeric moon call. Eyes still closed, he collapsed into a chair, kicked off one shoe, stripped away the sock, braced the shotgun with both hands, put the barrel in his mouth, raised his unshod foot, and touched one bare toe to the cold trigger. Imagined moonlight on his skin and imagined lunar tides in his blood, no less forceful for being imaginary, demanded his attention with such sudden power that he opened his eyes, saw the many moons on the walls, and cried, "No!" into the barrel of the gun. Even as the spellbinding moon call pulled him back toward a trance, even as he pressed his foot down upon the trigger, the swelling memory balloon at last burst in his mind, and he remembered everything that had been taken away from him.
The summer before last, Dominic, Ginger, Fay, Ernie, the young priest, the others, Interstate 80, the Tranquility Motel. Oh, God, the motel, and oh, God, the moon.
Perhaps Zebediah Lomax was unable to check the downward motion of his bare foot, or perhaps, instead, the suddenly revealed memory was so terrible that it encouraged suicide. Whichever the case, the 12-gauge went off with a roar, and the back of his head blew out, and for him, though for no one else, the terror ended. Boston, Massachusetts. All Christmas afternoon, Ginger Weiss read Twilight in Babylon, and at 7 o'clock that evening, when it was time to go downstairs for drinks and dinner with the Hannaby family, she resented the interruption and did not want to put the book aside. She was a willing captive of the engrossing story, but she was more captivated by the photo of the author. Dominic Corvaces's commanding eyes and dark good looks continued to arouse in her an uneasiness bordering on fear, and she could not overcome the peculiar feeling that she knew him. Dinner with her hosts, their children and grandchildren, might have been pleasurable if Dominic Corvaces had not exerted a mysteriously powerful claim on her attention. At 10 o'clock, when she could at last gracefully withdraw without offending anyone, she cast out and gathered in a final series of Christmas wishes for happiness and health, then returned to her room. She began reading where she had left off, and with a minimum of interruptions to scrutinize the author's photograph again, she finished the book at 3:45 a.m. In the deep post-midnight silence that had settled over Baywatch, Ginger sat with the book in her lap, the jacket photo turned up, her eyes fixed on Dominic Corvaces's hauntingly familiar face. Minute by minute, as she sat in her strange, silent, one-sided communion with the writer's image, Ginger became increasingly convinced that she had met the man somewhere, and that he was, in some unimaginable fashion, part of her recent troubles. Although her steadily growing conviction was tempered by the realization that this intuition might be part of the same mental disturbance that generated her fugues and might therefore be unreliable, her agitation and excitement increased until, shaky and distraught, she was finally driven to action. Leaving her room with exaggerated stealth, she went downstairs through the dark and untenanted rooms of the great slumbering house into the kitchen. She switched on the light and used the wall phone to call information in Laguna Beach. It was 1 o'clock in the morning in California. Too rude an hour to wake Corvaces. But if she could get a number for him, she would sleep better, knowing that she could get in touch with him in the morning. To her dismay, though not to her surprise, his number was unlisted. Switching off the kitchen light and creeping quietly back to her room, Ginger made up her mind to write Corvaces in the morning, care of his publisher. She would dispatch the message by express mail with an urgent plea to the publisher to forward the letter immediately. Perhaps attempting to contact him was precipitate and irrational. Perhaps she had never met him, and perhaps he had nothing to do with her bizarre affliction. Perhaps he thinks she was a crackpot. But if this million-to-one shot proved a good bet, the payoff might be her very salvation, which was sufficient reward to risk making a fool of herself. Laguna Beach, California. As yet unaware that an advance review copy of his book had made a vital link between himself and the deeply troubled woman in Boston, Dom remained at Parker Fane's house until midnight, discussing the possible nature of the conspiracy that he had theorized. Neither he nor Parker had enough information to put together a detailed or even slightly useful picture of the conspirators, but the very process of sharing and exploring the mystery with a friend made it less frightening. They agreed that Dom should not fly to Portland and begin his odyssey until he saw how bad his sleepwalking became, now that he had thrown away the Valium and Dalmain. Maybe somnambulism would not recur, as he expected it would, in which case he could travel without fear of losing control of himself in a distant place. But if he resumed his night rambling, he would need a couple weeks to decide on the best way of restraining himself during sleep, before heading to Portland. Besides, by waiting a while he might receive additional letters from his unknown correspondent. Those clues might make the trek from Portland to Mountain View unnecessary, or might target a specific area along that route as the place where Dom would encounter some sight or experience that would free his imprisoned memories. By midnight, when Dom rose to leave Parker's hillside house, the artist had become so intrigued by the situation that he looked as if he would be up for hours yet, his mind spinning. "You sure it's wise to be alone tonight?" he asked at the front door. Dom stepped outside onto a walkway patterned with spiky, geometric forms of darkness and wedge-shaped slices of yellow light, which were formed by the beams of a decorative iron lantern half-obscured by shadow-casting palm fronds. Looking back at his friend, he said, "We've been through this before. It might not be wise, but it's the only way."
"You'll call if you need help."
"I'll call," Dom said.
"And take those precautions we talked about."
Dom attended to those precautions a short while later at home. He removed the pistol from his nightstand, locked it in a drawer of his office desk, and buried the desk key under a package of ice cream in the freezer. Better to be unprepared for a burglar than to risk firing the gun while sound asleep. Next, from a coil of rope in the garage, he cut a 10-foot length. After brushing his teeth and undressing, he knotted one end of the line securely around his right wrist in such a way that he could escape only by untying 4 difficult knots. He secured the other end of the rope to one post of the headboard, taking care to fasten it tightly. With 1 foot of the line's length used for the knots, he was left with 9 feet of play, enough to assure his comfort while keeping him tethered within a safe distance of the bed. In previous somnambulistic episodes, he had performed complex tasks that had required some concentration, though nothing quite so tedious as the unraveling of well-made knots, which were often a challenge to him when he was awake. In his sleep, he would surely lack the coordination and mental focus to free himself, and the effort to do so would be frustrating enough to wake him. Being thus hampered involved some danger. If a fire broke out in the night, or if the house were damaged in an earthquake, he might be so delayed by the need to untie himself that he would perish in the smoke or beneath a collapsing wall. He had to risk it. When he turned out the bedside light and slipped under the blanket, trailing the rope from one arm, the glowing red numerals of the digital clock read 12:58. Staring at the dark ceiling, wondering what in the name of God he had become involved in out there on the road the summer before last, he waited for sleep to creep upon him. On the nightstand, the telephone was silent. If his number had not been unlisted, he might have received, at that moment, a long-distance call from a lonely and frightened young woman in Boston, a call that would have radically changed the course of the next few weeks and might have saved lives. Milwaukee, Wisconsin. In the guest room of her only daughter's house, where a nightlight burned in consideration of Ernie's phobia, Fay Block listened to her husband as, asleep and dreaming, he mumbled into his pillow. A few minutes ago she had been awakened when he had let out a soft cry and had thrashed for a moment in the sheets. Now she raised herself on one elbow, cocked her head, and listened intently, trying to decipher his muffled speech. He was saying the same thing again and again into the pillow. The almost panicky urgency in his voice made Fay nervous. She leaned closer to him, straining to understand. Suddenly, he shifted his head just enough to turn his mouth from the pillow, and his words became clear, though no less mysterious than when they had been muffled.
"A moon. A moon. A moon. A moon."
Las Vegas, Nevada. Georgia took Marcy into her own bed that night, because it did not seem like a good idea to leave the girl alone after the disturbing events of the day. She did not get much rest, because all night Marcy seemed to phase in and out of nightmares, frequently kicking at the sheets, squirming vigorously as if to free herself from restraining hands, and talking in her sleep about doctors and needles. Georgia wondered how long this had been going on. Their bedrooms were separated by back-to-back closets, insulated by hanging clothes, and the child's sleep talk was very soft, so it was possible that she had passed a lot of nights in unconscious terror without Georgia being aware of it. Her voice raised goose flesh on Georgia's arms. In the morning she would take Marcy to the doctor. Given her unexplained dread of all physicians, the girl might cause a hell of a scene. But as much as Marcy feared going to a doctor, Georgia feared not going. If it had not been so hard to locate the right physician on Christmas Day, Georgia would have gone for help already. She was scared. Following Marcy's outburst, when her grandfather's teasing about taking her to a hospital had driven her away from the table in a mad panic, the day had gone downhill. The girl was so overcome by fear that she peed her pants, and for 10 or 15 hideously embarrassing and terrifying minutes, she resisted all George's efforts to get her cleaned up. She screamed, scratched, and kicked. The tantrum passed at last, and she submitted to a bath. But she was like a little zombie, slack-faced and empty-eyed, as if the terror in passing out of her had taken with it all her strength and her mind as well. That quasi-catatonic state lasted almost an hour while Georgia made a dozen telephone calls in an attempt to track down Dr. Bezencourt, the pediatrician who treated Marcy on those rare occasions when she was sick. As Mary and Pete tried unsuccessfully to get a smile, or at least a word of response from the stricken girl, and as Marcy continued to act as if she were deaf and mute, Georgia's mind was increasingly filled with half-remembered magazine articles about autistic children. She couldn't recall whether autism was a condition that began in infancy, or whether it was possible for a perfectly normal little girl of 7 to suddenly withdraw into a private place and close out the rest of the world forever. Not being able to remember made her a little crazy. Gradually, however, Marcy came out of her daze. She began to answer Mary and Pete, though in one-word replies delivered in a flat, emotionless voice nearly as unsettling as her screams had been earlier. Sucking on her thumb as she had not done in at least 2 years, she went into the living room to play with her new toys. Most of the afternoon she played without any visible pleasure, a faint scowl having taken unchallenged possession of her small face. Georgia was no less worried because of this change, but she was relieved to see that Marcy showed no further interest in the little Miss Doctor kit. By 4:30 the girl's scowl had faded, and she had become sociable once more.
In a good mood again, she was such a natural charmer that she almost made it seem as if her outburst at the table had been no worse than any child's temper tantrum. In fact, on the outside stairs of the apartment complex, beyond Marcy's hearing, George's mother paused on the way down to the car and said,
"She's just trying to let us know that she's hurt and confused. She doesn't understand why her father left, and right now she needs a lot of special attention, Georgia. A lot of love. That's all."
Georgia knew the problem was worse than that. She had no doubt that Marcy was still disturbed by her father's behavior, deeply hurt by his abandonment, and full of unresolved conflicts. But something else was eating the girl, something that seemed disturbingly irrational, and Georgia was scared of it. Not long after Pete and Mary left, the girl began playing Little Miss Doctor with the same unnerving intensity she had exhibited earlier, and when bedtime came, she wanted to take the kit with her. Now, some of the Little Miss Doctor things lay on the floor at Marcy's side of the bed, some on the nightstand. And in the dark bedroom, the child dreamed and whimpered about doctors, nurses, needles. Georgia would have been unable to sleep even if Marcy had been perfectly still and quiet. Worry induced insomnia even more effectively than a dozen cups of coffee. Since she was awake anyway, she listened attentively to her daughter's every dreamy utterance, hoping that she would hear something that would help her understand or that would assist the doctor in arriving at his diagnosis. It was after 2 o'clock in the morning when Marcy mumbled something different from what she had mumbled before, something that had nothing to do with doctors and nurses and big sharp needles. With a flurry of violent kicks, the girl flopped from her stomach onto her back, gasped, and went rigid, perfectly still.
"The moon, moon, the moon," she said,
in a voice that was filled with both amazement and fear.
"The moon."
A voice of such chilling, whispery urgency that Georgia knew it was not just meaningless sleep talk.
"The moon. Moon. Moon."
Chicago, Illinois. Brendan Cronin, priest on probation, slept warmly under a blanket and patchwork quilt, smiling at something in a dream. The winter wind sighed through the giant pine tree outside, fluted and soughed in the eaves, and moaned at his window, exerting itself in evenly spaced gusts as if nature were ventilating the night with a huge mechanical bellows that faithfully produced 8 exhalations to the minute. Even lost in his dream, Brendan must have been aware of the wind's slow pulse, for when he began to talk in his sleep, the words issued from him in a sympathetic rhythm.